issues in Ghana right now?
I think the issues has to do with poverty, food security, and the issue of how do we get access in terms of markets for many products that the country exports.
Okay, and can you maybe tell us a little bit about the history of the country, just as far as why it's in the condition it's in, as far as, you know, having a democracy and the main development issues that are there?
I think Ghana was a British colony, and we gained independence in 1957. And after independence, we took various development paths, and I think that's brought us where we are now. And in terms of socialist, capitalist, pro, mixed economy, all various aspects, and I think all that's not work has not worked well, so we are where we are now. But we are moving forward. There's, I mean, a great potential that we are moving forward.
Okay, and how would you say the country is, maybe in comparison to other West African neighbors, just for those who aren't that familiar with West Africa, sort of give them an idea of where it's at?
I think it's in West Africa. We are bordered by Burkina Faso, Togo, and then La Côte d'Ivoire. And we are more or less a stable country, peaceful, very hospitable people, if I may say. And then I also think we are the gateway to West Africa.
Why do you say that?
I think in terms of our economy, as well as we have a large coast, and most of the other neighboring countries border are landlocked, so we provide seaports to their goods. So,
and if someone was to come to Ghana having never been there before, what would they expect to see?
Great welcome, the normal Ghanaian Akwaaba you expect, and then various tourist attractions, and it's a whole lot of other activities going in Ghana. You were there in the summer, yeah. So you could tell what you experienced. But one thing I can promise you is the Ghanaian hospitality. It's great.
And can you just set for us a little bit of sort of the social and cultural situation there, as far as tribes and languages and diversity that way?
I think it's a very diverse community, and we have about 49 main dialects which are spoken, but we have minor ones as well, and we have various, the major ethnic groups happens to be about 6, which are the Akans, the Ewes, the Guans, the Gans, and various groups, and most are located in the southern sector, but we have the northern aspect as well, and the northern is also quite diverse. Yeah.
Okay, and so you're native Ghanaian, but you're now Canadian as well. How long have you been here?
Been here for 3 years now. Yeah.
And did you come here just to go to university?
Yes, that's the main reason, yeah.
And so why did you decide, once you were here, to go back to Ghana to do your research?
I think I decided to go back to Ghana, especially to look at an issue that it's been bothering me all about the time. That has to do with an aspect of food security in northern Ghana. It's one of the hot spots in terms of food shortages each year. So I wanted to see what was wrong. But then many people have assessed the situation, and the issues has always been on the supply side of the issue, that is unavailability of food and the fact that people don't get access to food. But I thought there was a missing variable which has to do with more or less the invisible part which many people don't see, which has to do with the culture aspects of food, and not necessarily the availability of food, but the consumption pattern as well, and how does this affect the level of food availability as help, or otherwise how people get access to food.
Okay, and so you are researching food security from a bit of a cultural aspect. And yeah. So before we get into that, can you just sort of give us a little bit of background on, say, maybe the yearly crop cycle in the north?
I think agriculture in Ghana is basically rain-fed. That is dependent on rain and its unpredictability, the risk of unpredictability of the rain. And what happens is that you have rainfall decreasing as you move from the south to the north. So what you notice is that in the southern sector, you have one main cropping season. In the north, in the south, you have 2 main cropping seasons, whilst in the north, you have only 1. And so that may be a factor in it, because whilst rainfall is bimodal in the south, it's only one in the north. So, and because of the climatic situation, the crops that are grown in the north are basically cereals as well, especially in Upper East.
And what are some of those main cereal crops, some of the main staple foods that they grow there?
I think it's sorghum, millet, and groundnuts mainly.
Yeah. And are these drought resistant? They're able to flourish in that kind of environment?
I think so.
And so why did you choose to look at food security issues in the north, given what you've just told us?
I think why I went there was to see whether the cultural variable, which I think has a role to play, how significant was that variable in terms of its contribution to the food insecurity situation.
And what were you thinking that you would find? What was your hypothesis?
I was looking at if there is food insecurity and the issue of supply and in terms of availability as well as the access, it's been whether these two aspects of the equation factor in the culture aspect, in the sense that through these culture things like food festivals and funerals, whether these two tilt the food balance sheet to the deficit that affects the food security in that part of our country.
Okay, that's very interesting. We're going to go to a little bit more music before we come back and get into that a little bit deeper. As always, if anyone has any questions, you can reach us at 837-2378.
weni sumpuna sana wababe imidie sabisa mayoko taya chimia shogra wa mumpa enya denara mifi unami andumundi misisi kapa wawedi ayodoko tuwa nesika panya baby I know if you sebi nima priye disike chiesa mwa kwa kogwe fiasi yeah ya mamu munyo sanseni if you sebi jambe una sonye nguya ya mfrenu jambu
with your hosts April and Nikki. This is a new show on CFRU that features interviews with Guelph graduate students who've lived, worked, traveled, or done research abroad. We're here today with Franklin Kutuadu, and we're talking to him about food security in northern Ghana. So one of the things that you mentioned, Franklin, was the cultural aspect of food security. And I'm wondering if you could tell us what exactly are you referring to when you talk about that?
I think what I mean by that, it's not necessarily the cultural acceptability of food, where people think the food that you people produce or consume must be, I mean, within their cultural context, what is acceptable to them. But what I'm looking at is within that local context, is there a consumption pattern that goes to tilt the food balance sheet to the deficit that it affects the food security situation or food security status of a household? That was what I was looking at. And so I took two main variables, that's festivals and funerals that are celebrated during the dry season in the district where I went.
And could you tell us about these festivals? When are they held and what are they for?
The festivals are mainly celebrated after harvest, which is the beginning of the lean season. And then they are mainly as a form of thanksgiving to the gods of the land for their protection and for the harvest given them and over the year, and ask for their protection for the coming year. That's what I'm told.
So you mentioned that there is one main rainy season up north where you're doing your research. So Can you talk a little bit just about what you mean by the lean season?
The lean season happens to be the dry season where there's no rainfall, and so they do not undertake farming activities. So basically, What happens within that time is that after the harvest, they do these feasts, which because the fact that there are no rainfall for interruptions and the rest, so that's why mainly these things are done after the dry season.
And how long is the lean season every year?
It's very long, normally starting from November up to April, where people start planting again.
Okay, and so it's during this time that basically people live off of what they've harvested that year, and they have no opportunity other than, you know, other outside aid opportunities to get more food.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's called the lean period. Yeah. And so then festivals held during this time, and then they feast, and so you're looking at, you know, the feasting that happens during this, using up food that could otherwise, is that right?
Yeah, and the impact of this, whether this one way or the other affect the food security status of the community.
And the other thing you mentioned then were the funerals. Can you tell us about that?
What happens is, for example, if somebody dies during the farming season or during the rainy season when they are cultivating, the normal burial is done, but the final funeral rites are kept in the lean season or the dry season. So it's a form of celebrating what we call here celebrating somebody's life, but it's done in a different dimension, in the sense that that's the time, if, for example, you are married to somebody and it's your in-law, you have to perform certain rites, and it's this time that you go to perform those rites, not necessarily after the person is dead. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how long are these feasts held for, and who participates in them?
The participation is everybody, every household is involved, and it's more like a social obligation for every household to be involved in the celebration of all these festivals. And what happens is that normally it starts, some of them takes a week, but it's not a week-long celebration, but it starts like Monday, a cleanup campaign, but the main feasting period starts from around Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Yeah.
So those are the feasts that last a week and the funerals last a week?
The funerals don't last a week, but the frequency of it's in the dry season is great. And because most households keep all their funerals to the dry season, so you see that the frequency in terms of the amount of food and the expenditures involved within that season, the peak season, is very great.
Okay, so you might have one household that has 5 or 6 funerals during that time period.
It may not be somebody dying necessarily in your household, but because it's a community where it's a bit more like a close community where they are interrelated and dependent on each other, what you see is that if your neighbor has a funeral, you must as well contribute either money or what you call food stuff towards that funeral, because if it's your turn, your neighbor will also do it. And so you see that though it may not be on the household in question, but they also supply help other people. So you see it involves more than one household, and the expenditure as well as the food that is used involves more than a household. And so in the community wise, you get huge tons of food going out during this period of time. Yeah.
And is HIV AIDS having any impact on this?
Actually, I didn't look at the aspect, but what you could see that is visible is the production levels are falling because there's a huge level of migration from that place to the southern sector. So that is one aspect. And we also have the climatic factor, which is the soils are now very fragile and infertile compared to the days where they used to have it without any problem. Because the most important aspect was that there was food security in this part of the north way, way back after independence. And I think the whole food security crisis in Ghana started after 1983, when we had the drought that swept throughout the whole country. Since that time, parts of northern Ghana and some parts in southern Ghana have not been food secure since that time. But the case of northern Ghana, and especially Bongo, this is more precarious because you have high incidence of poverty around these areas. But then we also have the same amount of, or the celebration of these festivals and funerals on the same magnitude as in the days of when we had a lot of food. And I think that's where my concern is.
Mm-hmm. So when you say food security, what you really mean is that everybody in every community all year long has enough food to eat?
That's by their definition, yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure that I knew what you were meaning. So are there differences now between the way the younger people and the older people are seeing the feasting and relating to the festivals and the funerals?
I think there is, because the young of my age type seems not to really value the significance of such feasting, because they feel, well, the question is, if they don't do it, will something happen? And the answer, they tell me no. But are they obliged to do it? Yes. So you find some of them telling me they leave for the festival, they leave the community and come back, but the funerals, they can't leave because you have to do it, because when it happens to you, two people will be there for you, so you have to help out during that time. But for the festival, yes, some people do leave.
So what happens if someone doesn't participate in the way they're expected to? Say there's, you know, a funeral for their in-laws that you mentioned, and they just don't have the food or just choose to not participate in that way. What will happen to them?
Well, it has some serious implications. For example, a young man told me that if you don't do it well for your in-law or your dad, when you have a problem and you consult the soothsayer, you'll be told that your misfortune as a result of not according your in-laws or your father a befitting burial. So you ought to go and do that. And I'm also told that when you don't do that, the dead who has gone into the other world will be resting in restlessness, so you have to do it. And on the issue of how women see it, women also told me that it's like the fact that you are not doing that, your children will come back to you and say, well, everybody is doing it in this community. Why are you not doing it? Why are we not doing it? Are we not part of this community? So I think the social obligation is so strong, and that makes a lot of people go into it, yeah.
So there's quite a bit of social pressure to provide a good feast.
Very, very much, I think so.
Mm-hmm. And among the men as well, is there social pressure?
I think among the men, and what I noticed is that basically there are two main festivals, what people call the traditional and the modern Christian one, which is celebrated by Catholics in their community. But although the Catholic one is just a one-day thing, so you have more women in that aspect of the Catholic funeral, the festival, and then you have men also more into the traditional festival.
So is it common for these villages, I know you're in one specific district, to actually run out of food if they have a lot of funerals that year?
Sure, and some of them, they extend to some people. Even, you know, this production, this area is subsistence, so people depend on previous season's harvest as a seed for sowing the coming season. So to the extent that some people even use their seed for food, that tells you the extent of the situation. And so during the coming season, they will have to rely on certain organizations to provide them seeds as a form of aid so that they could grow crops. And so it's, to me, it's very serious. And they themselves see it as a problem, because to them, I'm told, in the absence of that, maybe they could food secured, or the food security, food, the hunger period could have been reduced by 2 months. That's to them. But talking to the extension officers, they also see it as a problem. But what the extension officers told me was that they see that the reduction or if in the absence of that, they could be food secure for an extra month, not necessarily 2 months, as the people see. So that's one aspect. But I think that it has an implication on the food security status of the community.
So they identify it as a problem, but do they want to do something about it? Because you said there's such, you know, a huge, extreme social pressure on it. Do they actually want to do something to rectify the situation, or are they looking for more external aid?
Yes, they are doing something to rectify it, but you have to trace the thing back to the traditional roots of it. With my focus group discussion with the chief and elders, one thing that came out clear is that it's like a tradition, and nobody wants to break the cycle of tradition in their time, and that is one pressure. So it wouldn't be what they will tell you in plain language, it wouldn't be my time that I would change this tradition. I mean, but my forefathers will not forgive me if I change this tradition during my time. And so you find this is as a problem, but there's other side of the coin, which is, when do you change it, and who will be responsible for changing it?
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you, within the homes, who is it who decides, who is it who allocates how much food will be used for the festival or for the funeral, and how much will be then saved for the post-harvest season?
I think Bongo district is just like any patriarchal society where the male at the head of the household decide what to do. And interestingly, it's the male that control the granaries, that's the store where the grains are stored, and it's the men that's responsible for the amount of food that should be used for the funerals, and they dish out the food that should be used, as well as the amount of money that should be spent. But that does not determine, they don't determine how much the women spend in terms of their own, what comes out of their own pocket in their expenditure when it comes to the festivals. But basically, it's the men who are in charge.
And what's the justification for this? Why do they say that it's necessary for the men to be in charge of the food distribution?
What I was told is that by the men, that's in terms of the men, I asked why, and was told that given that women have close attachment to their children, they will not be very efficient in rationing their food to take them for a long time. But if they are in charge, that could help them ration it for a long time. And that was quite interesting to me.
So the women actually saw, or the men actually saw it as a negative thing, that the women would be more careful in rationing the food throughout the year?
It's rather not careful, because, for example, if the time has come, for example, if you can, let's say, eat one food a day or not necessarily three meals a day, but if the children are hungry and they come to the mother cannot help it but dish out some food for them. But and that could not take them for a longer time period, so they feel the women may not be able to do that. But on the side of the women too, they feel it's because the men want to be in control. And so it's two sides of the coin. The women have a different version. The men have a different version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go to a little bit more music now. As always, if you have any questions, we can be reached at 837-2378. What we're going to be playing now is a little bit of Canadian reggae, because reggae is one of the most popular forms of music in Ghana. So we have a local artist, and the CD is Souls of the Righteous.
Thank you.
welcome back to Going Global with your hosts, April and Nikki. So as we said before the break, reggae is really popular in Ghana, and that was not reggae. That was supposed to be a Canadian reggae song. It was actually more Ghanaian music. We'll play Canadian reggae a little bit later in the show. For those who just joined us, we're here with Franklin Kutuadu, and we're talking to him about his research with food security in northern Ghana, and how there's a long lean season every year where the locals have to live off of what they've harvested with no additional food coming in, and the implications of that when there are festivals and funerals and they feast, and this can take up more food, causing them to run out of food actually before they're able to grow and harvest more. So Franklin, can you maybe start now just by telling us a little bit about the implications of feasting soon after the harvest season?
I think what I notice is that there's a huge amount of food and expenditure, from what I'm told through the questionnaire administration as well as the interviews I had with them. And this in a long way goes to affect the food security status, in the sense that, for example, if the amount of income had not been used during the festivals and the funerals, then that could have been used to access food in times of food insecurity, or where they are running short food in terms of food shortages. And in terms of the food, it reduces the availability of food to the household. So that's the basically that's the implications of those feastings. Because, I mean, festivals are celebrated in every part of Ghana, but then I look at in terms of the production and then the consumption in terms of this area where I went to, and I felt the consumption pattern fit into it, in the sense that it affects the food balance sheet to the deficit.
So just to give people a little bit of a visual idea, if I was to walk into a village where there was a funeral going on, what would I expect to see? How long would it be going on? What type of food would be available?
How long? Not so long. Normally a day or two. And then the food also depends on the crops that are grown in that area. And then you also you'll be expected to see many rites. I mean, the rites are different in terms of an in-law performing a rite for their father or mother-in-law. You also expect somebody performing a different rites for his or her husband. And then for an elderly person, whether it's a chief or a head of clan, the funerals also differ. And then you also expect that the festivals, there's what we call the sacrificial aspect, which is they go to where they have some shrines and the rest, and they sacrifice. But the sacrifice, what is sacrifice actually is not so much. But I think it's what is the feasting, that's what I think it's the problem, and then the expenditure involved in it.
And so how does this feasting affect the yearly hunger cycles?
I think it affects in the sense that the yearly hunger cycle starts from March to June, which is a four-month period. And so if an expenditure or food usage within a period of time is in such a way that, for example, the expenditure goes beyond the normal daily expenditure and the usage of food goes beyond the normal daily usage of food or consumption of food, to the extent that it takes away the availability food which would have been used in the lean season, or the income which would have been used to access food during the lean season, then the hunger period, which I'm saying it's 4 months, to some households is even more than 4 months because of certain things, and you are obliged to do it because of the social implications attached to it. Yeah.
And what are the long-term impacts of this yearly hunger cycle?
I think the long-term impacts is just like what we see in terms of malnutrition. And I think that the children, to me, are the most at risk here, because their psychological development, their growth is being affected because of the fact that you do not have food all year round, which affects your mental capability along the way. And so what you see now is some organizations coming in, and what the World Vision is doing, what they call the food, the children feeding program, where children are fed to go to schools, so that in that they can retain them in schools to get formal education, that they can, in the long term, they can get them off the land because of the situation.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find were people's attitudes towards long-term planning in general?
I will look at it in terms of long-term planning vis-a-vis in terms of the funeral and the festivals. For example, you ask them, if, for example, you do these festivals now, how about next 3 months or next 4 months if you are without food? And from that I noticed that the concern is about now, because it's like the social discomfort from you not being able to participate in the festival or, let's say, do the funeral rites of your in-laws. The social implications seems to be greater than what you may experience in the months ahead. And besides, what happens in that case is that, nobody knows what tomorrow will bring. Maybe next time we may not even go hungry. So why do you not do what you're supposed to do now? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of, you mentioned the food program in schools for children. What other kind of food aid do these communities receive if and when they do run out of food?
Some organizations give them food aid in times of emergency, like the Cali Relief Agency in the Bongo District. And then we also have World Vision, which provides the food for school, I may call it, for them. So these are some of the food aid. And we have now, USAID provides food aid, but now they channel it through Cali Relief Agency. So they are, because they are on the ground, the local organization on the ground, they know the situation. So they are the organization that channels this food aid to the people. And mostly the food is given to the most vulnerable in the society. That's the children, the elderly, and those who are sick. And now people with HIV/AIDS, that's another crop of people that have been added to the vulnerability list.
Mm-hmm. And aside from through the schools, how is the food actually distributed? Do people line up for it, or how do people go house to house and distribute it?
They have local committees that handle this, because the local committees are from the people from the community who know people in the community and will be able to identify the more vulnerable people in the society. So the organizations work through local committees that they set up.
Mm-hmm. Is there any social stigma attached to receiving food aid? Is it seen as shameful, or is it seen as something that's normal?
It's not seen shameful as such, but it's like an assistance given to somebody. So to them, it's not shameful, but they would have preferred being assisted to increase their own the production of their own local crops compared to being given food aid. That is what I noticed from my field work.
Now, you mentioned that essentially people would rather face going hungry than the social stigma attached with not providing food at festivals and funerals. So what would you recommend to help break this cycle, dealing within that context of there is such a huge social stigma attached to this?
From Ghana myself, you cannot do away with funerals. And funerals and then festivals, they are part of our social fabric. And it's a way that people get together, and sometimes it's a way to raise money for development projects and other things. So what I would call for is a moderation. And fortunately, my interaction with the extension offices, provided this evidence that I went to 3 main communities within the Bongo District. There is another community which was not part of my sample communities, but I was told there is a moderation there from the local authorities. For example, on the cap of how much you should spend or how much amount of food you could use for these festivals because of this problem. And so I think there could be a moderation, and that will go a long way, but you cannot stop people from taking part of their whole life, because culture is their way of life.
So what are some of the implications of your research for other areas that suffer from periods of hunger, maybe not through, exactly the same festivals and funerals?
I think what I would want us to look to us in terms of people in field work and then in the developing world is to look at, is to go more into the issues that were forgotten and then which were invisible in the times. Like, for example, people, the culture variable that is always missing in planning. Most people negate the culture variable. It's very important because I think even if you increase production and you increase people's access to food and the magnitude of festivals are still the same, you still have food shortages. So we should look at the missing variables that were not taken into consideration at first. And I also think circumstances vary. So I don't know the circumstances of other communities, but in the case of Pongo, I think it's one aspect of their culture that we have to take. They have to take a critical look and moderate the way things are done in this aspect.
Great, thanks. As always, if you have any questions, you can call us at 837-2378. We're going to go to a little bit more music now and then come back and talk to Franklin about exactly how he did this research and what his future plans are. This will hopefully be Canadian reggae this time. Again, the same CD, The Souls Are of the Righteous, are in the hands of Ja.
Only I know.
Welcome back to Going Global. We're here with Franklin Kutuadu, talking to him about his research in Ghana with food securities. Franklin, now you're a native Ghanaian and you're here studying in Canada, and I'm kind of curious as to how, you know, leaving your country and then going back to the to do research there, how were you received?
Well, I'm from the southern part of Ghana, and I went to the north of Ghana, but I had an experience with the north for some time, and I happened to have some contacts in the north. But I think I was really welcome in terms of the local people, that's the people in the Bunga district, and I must thank them so much. But what I think was more interesting was in terms of the public offices. I think I had a hell of a problem getting data from them. Because they tell you, go come. It's a lot of red tape, and it is very, very frustrating. But with the community, it was very spectacular. I think I was encouraged, and because they were always there, and they were ready to help you with anything. But unfortunately, when you come to the public service or the civil service, where you needed some of the stars from governments, some are there, just not there. But instead of you being told, well, we can't get this for you, they tell you, go come today, go come tomorrow, and virtually you have to leave without getting them.
Do you think that anybody would have faced that kind of runaround from the officials, or do you think that was particularly strong for you because you're Ghanaian?
I think it was strong for me more because of Ghana, but I think other researchers too faced that problem. I had a colleague who also faced that problem.
Yeah, I have to say, when I was doing research there, I faced a very similar problem as well. Go and come tomorrow and we will maybe have it. And then they do. They a week later, oh, we don't have that.
Yeah, and sometimes just a meeting with two people to get the two sides of the same, to get two sides with the two of you sitting in the same room so that you don't get, like, conflicting statements. They will always tell, well, we can't meet you. We can't meet you. I can't meet these people with you. I can't meet these people with you. And sometimes a bit frustrating, yeah.
So is the community that you worked in, the community members themselves, are they waiting to hear the results of this research?
Yeah, I'm supposed to send back a copy to the district assembly, who and then it will eventually reach them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how did you gain access to the community? Did you have to get special permission from somebody? And what was that process like?
I think I had a bit of my undergrad in northern Ghana, so I know I had some contacts there. So what happened is that I went to the district assembly, met with the regional planner, who then introduced me to the assemblyman, or what we call here the local councillor for the various communities. And then the local councillor would then, or the assemblyman as we called him, would then introduce you to the chiefs and elders. Then you have to perform what we call the community entry process, which is like giving drinks and cola nuts to seek their consent. And then before you start the whole research process. And so you are under their protection and care during your stay in that community. Yeah.
And so for those who don't know, the district assembly is sort of the local government officials that work with the national democratic process, and then they also work in conjunction with the chiefs and elders, who are the traditional government form. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So what do you feel you learned most personally from this experience?
I think I learned a lot from northern Ghana, and that's in comparison to where I come from, which is in southern Ghana in the Volta region. In terms of one interesting thing I learned was the management of natural resources in terms of common property resources like trees. In times of hunger, people depend on wild trees and wild things as a way of reducing hunger, as a way of getting food. And what I noticed that, for example, in southern Ghana, or where I come from, when you have a portion of land and there's a tree or a fruit tree on it, so far as that land is yours, that tree, you can harvest fruits from it. But in Bongo district, that is not the same. You could own the land, but you could not own the tree belongs to a different person. And there are rules and regulations as to how you may access the fruits. So although you may have fruits, a tree with fruits on your land, that does not belong to you, so you don't have access to it. And that was quite interesting to me as well. And then in terms of access to land, the process seems to be more easier in northern Ghana than compared to southern Ghana. I don't know whether because of the vast land they have, but I think the process is less cumbersome than what we have in southern Ghana. So those are the things that I learned that were new to me.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find to be most challenging to you personally?
The greatest challenge was getting to the communities. Most of the roads were not motorable, and sometimes we have vehicle breakdowns on the road. I have to sit at the backs of motorbikes to get to some villages, and it's quite risky sometimes. And that was the most challenging aspect.
Mm. And can you tell us about your future plans? What are you hoping to do after graduation? Are you planning to go back and work in this area, or what are you thinking about?
I plan to work in after school. I plan to work in the development field, not necessarily back in Ghana, but in the development field.
In food security, do you think, or something else entirely?
Actually, I've been doing development studies all my university life, so I'll be more interested in doing anything that regards development.
Okay, thank you so much, and thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it. It's been Franklin, who did his work in food security in northern Ghana. And thank you for joining us for another edition of Going Global. If you have any questions or are interested in being on the show, you can always reach us by email at nwhaites@uoguelph.ca. Thanks, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Onyame Womba for a bread. Oh, what man can hear you? Don't ever chance him in
This is the BBC.
It's 1800 GMT. I'm Anu Anand, and this is World Have Your Say from the BBC. Your agenda, your news.
They're doing these things under Islam, but Islam is not like this at all. I don't think anyone supports them here.
Today, after the Jordan bombings, Kofi Annan again calls for a global convention against terrorism. But will it make the slightest difference to Al-Qaeda? Tell us what you think. World Have Your Say at bbc.co.uk. Also, have Liberia's voters smash the glass ceiling for women to come out on top in Africa? And taking the rap, should we be turning down the volume of gangster music? World, have your say. Take part in the global conversation. First, the news.
BBC News, I'm Francis Lyne. Hundreds of supporters of a Liberian presidential candidate, the former international footballer George Weah, have been staging angry demonstrations in the centre of the capital, Monrovia, but there was no serious violence. The final results of the election have yet to be announced, but Mr. Weah's opponent, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, declared she had won after international observers judged the election to be broadly free and fair. Mr. Weah says the election was rigged, but he urged his supporters not to turn to violence. From Monrovia, Mark Doyle reports.
In the end, the George Weah rally was peaceful because Weah, acting more like an elder statesman than a flashy centre-forward, told his people to put peace first and peace last. He would be taking his rigging allegations to the Supreme Court, not to the streets. This is highly unusual for Liberia, a country where for the past generation, disputes like this have been settled by guns. If, as seems overwhelmingly likely, Mrs. Johnson Sirleaf is officially confirmed as the winner of this poll, it will be partly thanks to George Weah's intervention that it went off smoothly.
President Bush has called on Syria to stop what he called attempts to destabilize its neighbor, Lebanon. Speaking at a Veterans Day event in the United States, Mr. Bush criticized the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, for what he termed a strident speech earlier in the week, and he demanded that President Assad cooperate with the UN investigator, Detlef.